This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy. Noam Chomsky, welcome to Sphinx Radio.
Very glad to be with you.
Now, Professor Chomsky, you just wrote a very, very telling and important article that is up on ZNet entitled "The Corporate Takeover of U.S. Democracy." Could you give us a few highlights, because this really addresses a very important decision the Supreme Court has just made about our country?
Yeah. Well, the occasion for the article was the Supreme Court decision on Citizens United. The decision rescinded a century of precedents going back to the 1907 Tillman Act, which imposed some restrictions, not very heavy ones, but some restrictions on corporate purchase, so by slight exaggeration, but not much, on the ability of corporations to essentially buy elections, you know, by huge spending, advertising, and so on in favor of candidates. There were restrictions. The Tillman Act was a restriction. There were other restrictions added later on. There were relaxing, like the Buckley case, which defined money as a kind of speech, and which is, you know, very, plenty of objections to that, and others. But it was, at least there were some restrictions. The Supreme Court decision a couple of weeks ago pretty much removed them. What it means is that corporations can spend freely without constraint on advertising to support the candidate of their choice, which gives them enormous, they already have enormous power over the political system. We can see that by what's been happening for the last couple of years under Obama. But this kind of opens the floodgates. It eliminates what limited constraints there were. Now, there are much deeper issues. First of all, when they talk about corporations, they actually mean corporate managers. About a century ago, the courts effectively identified corporations with management. The managers are identical to the corporation. So it means that the ones who can spend the money are basically the managers. They can spend shareholders' money freely in support of the candidate of their choice. The dissent by Justice Stevens pointed out accurately that the courts had already granted corporations, meaning corporate managers, the rights of freedom of speech as a corporate entity, not, of course, as individuals. They can do whatever they like. Yes, their freedom of speech, but had given the collectivist entity, which is a state-created entity, given enormous privileges by the state. So this privileged state-created entity, as Stevens pointed out, had been given the right of freedom of speech. Well, that goes back to decisions about a century ago, which solidified earlier proposals, which had been kind of, you know, scattered and vague, but they were solidified in the early 20th century, which gave corporations, collectivist legal entities, the rights of persons, of human beings, persons of flesh and blood. That was a very dramatic not only are these corporate persons entitled to all the rights of flesh and blood persons, but they have to be a special kind of person, the kind of person who we would probably send for therapy or put in a mental institution if he had flesh and blood. They are committed by law to one goal, namely maximizing profit and market share. It's like a human being who lacks any sympathy or concern for others, and is just manically committed to one thing, gaining as much for himself as possible. I mean, we'd consider that pathology. It has to be treated. But that's the nature of corporate personhood. Well, it goes on and gets worse as you come towards more recent times. These corporate entities have been given rights that go far beyond those of persons. So, for example, in the trade agreements, which are they're called free trade agreements, but they don't have very much to do with free trade or even trade for the most part, say NAFTA and the other trade agreements, these entities are given rights that humans can't dream of. So, for example, if General Motors invests in Mexico, if they set up a plant in Mexico, they can demand what's called national treatment. They must be treated like a Mexican business. Okay, suppose a Mexican comes to New York and asks for national treatment. He wants to be treated like an American. He'll be lucky if he doesn't end up in Guantanamo. These are rights among the many rights that the corporations have been granted that humans don't have. They also have, the fundamental basis of a corporation is what's called limited liability. That's what makes it a corporation. Well, maybe you can argue it's a good thing, maybe it's a bad thing, whatever you think about it. It effectively grants the human beings who are involved in corporations the right to commit crimes with impunity because of limited liability. So corporate manslaughter is an enormous phenomenon, but there's very little punishment of it because of limited liability, and of course because the corporations have so much power over the political process and the justice system. There's some academic studies of this which are quite interesting. But so these are state-created institutions supported by state power, granted extraordinary rights by state power, now rights far beyond persons. And now, according to the Citizens United case, they are also granted the right to essentially buy elections freely, directly, instead of doing it indirectly and in convoluted ways. So if they've been largely doing it in the past. That's a very severe blow against the foundations, what's left of the foundations of democracy. There were some very interesting aspects to the decision, which the press didn't point out, but take the majority decision written by Justice Kennedy. His decision includes the harshest, most extreme condemnation of the U.S. media that I have ever seen. There's plenty of critique of the media, like, Danny Schechter, who we were talking about before, has been a critic of the media. I have too, so have others. But nothing has ever appeared that's as severe as Kennedy's criticism, though he probably didn't understand he was making it. And what he said is, he said correctly, we've granted freedom of speech to media corporations, like CBS has freedom of speech. And so he doesn't see any reason why it shouldn't be granted to other corporations, like, say, General Electric. Well, I think what he's saying, General Electric is a corporate entity required by law to do nothing but maximize profit and power. CBS is a corporate entity, as is the New York Times and so on, but they aren't given the benefits of corporate incorporation by the state because they're supposed to fulfill a public trust. The public trust is to provide information, opinion, honestly, without bias, and so on. They've often been accused of violating that public trust, but what Kennedy was actually saying is they don't have that public trust. So if they want to do nothing but act of the court in order to raise this minor issue to an issue of extreme significance, one which is so significant it would take a constitutional amendment to go to overturn it. And he managed to ram it through with the five reactionary justices voting for it, you know, him and the other four Bush appointees. Well, okay, that's, there actually was an interesting article a couple of days ago in the Wall Street Journal about how the court, the mechanisms by which the court is shifting, steadily shifting to the right, to the right-wing extremist end, of which this is an example. And what they pointed out is that in the days when the political parties were functioning more or less as political parties, you know, it's by now pretty much in the past, the appointees tended to be, you know, the president, whoever it was, would pick somebody more or less compatible, but somebody kind of acceptable to the general opinion or to the other party. That was the practice until recently. The Republicans have turned themselves into something really unique in U.S. politics. First of all, they observe strict party discipline on almost anything. So every vote, all the time, is unanimous, kind of like the old Communist Party. You observe party discipline. Secondly, they have basically no policies. Right now, their one policy is no. Whatever the Obama administration suggests, no, unanimously. The only other policy is let's give away even more to the rich and the wealthy than we already do. And when they've come in to power, like under the Bush administration, they have tended to pick extremely reactionary justices. Just go through the ones who voted in this case. When the Democrats come in, they tend to pick somebody who's sort of a centrist liberal. I mean, nothing like the extremist fringe that the Republicans pick. So there's a kind of a steady, natural drift towards the right, as the Wall Street Journal pointed out, and as we in fact saw at the latest decision. These are there are really far-reaching issues here, going way back to the a century ago, to the decision to assign personal rights, and later far more than personal rights, to collectivist legal entities. In fact, to be precise, to the management of collectivist legal entities, which are established and sustained by state power and given extraordinary rights even without this. So these are deep issues for, you know, what is left of American democracy.
Now, very bizarre situation, Professor Chomsky. And in your article, you also talked a bit about this Tea Party movement in the election in our own state of a fellow named Scott Brown as senator. And just to let people know, Scott Brown is in the U.S. National Guard. He's an attorney by training, and he's also for things like torture and waterboarding. And here in Massachusetts, we also have a famous professor at Harvard Law School, whose name I won't mention, who's also for torture. Do you see all of this as a movement more towards this radical right-wing extreme you're talking about in the court?
Well, the Massachusetts election was quite interesting. It's been it's pretty dramatic. I mean, the Senate position that the Republicans won was Ted Kennedy's position. Kennedy was known as, you know, the liberal lion, is what he was called. He was the one of the last voices of the sort of moderate welfare state, you know, New Deal style liberalism, and there are a few others, but he was the most outspoken one. And in fact, he had dedicated much of his career to trying to do something about the outrageous American healthcare system, which is really a disaster, which is going to destroy the federal budget. You just take a look at the projections. I mean, it has about twice the per capita costs of comparable societies, other industrial societies, and has some of the worst outcomes. And the reason is, it's the only system, the main reason is, it's the only system that is largely privatized and unregulated, almost unregulated. Well, you know, when you have an unregulated private system, it's going to induce enormous costs, and it does. Also leaves maybe 50 million people uninsured and many more underinsured. Well, Kennedy was in the lead of trying to do something about that. And Scott Brown, who was just elected, part of his plank was to be the 41st vote, which would block any health reform. Or whatever you think about the health reform bill in Congress, I have a lot of criticisms of it, at least with something. Why the 41st vote? Well, that's because the new Republican Party, departing from what a political party used to be, insists, and with the agreement of right-wing Democrats, succeeds in requiring that any legislation be on anything be passed by a supermajority. They threaten a filibuster otherwise. So it's a strong step against majority rule. You can't pass anything unless you have a supermajority. Well, you know, the filibuster had been used in the past, but it was, you know, a scattered occasions. Now it's uniform. In fact, Senator Shelby just recently announced that he's putting every Obama appointment on hold. Okay. That means it'll take, I don't know what they're appointed for, you know, some administrator somewhere, who they are. They're all on hold. They can't be nominated unless you get a supermajority, which with the Brown election you can't. And the Republicans acting like the Communist Party, strict party discipline. That's something really new in modern American history. It's maybe American history altogether. If you take a look at the election, it's quite interesting. It was described as a kind of a populist uprising against you know, the elitist policies of the Democrats and so on. There's something to that, but it's a little more complex. For one thing, if you look at the exit, at the voting record, which we have and have had for some time, it turns out that there was very heavy voting pro-Brown, pro-Republican, in the wealthy suburbs. There was very low voting, low turnout in the urban Democratic areas, which is the majority of the population. So it was essentially won by the combination of the real strong support engagement in the election by the wealthy suburbs and the lack of interest for the most part in the poor majority Democratic areas. Furthermore, it has now turned out that in the last, towards the end of the election, there was a huge flow of money for Brown from the financial institutions. Now, that's quite interesting. The financial institutions are the ones who put Obama into office. They preferred him to McCain, and that's sort of the core of his funding. And they were rewarded. They got what they wanted. That's what the huge bailout is about, the big bonuses, and, you know, limited efforts to do anything about the main economy. It's what it's all about. And there's a lot of anger about that. Well, in response to the public anger, Obama, in the last couple of weeks, started changing his rhetoric. He was just started talking about the big banks and the greed and got to do something about it and so on. And the financial institutions wasted no time in giving him a lecture saying, okay, you change your rhetoric, we'll destroy you. Just the way we put you into office, we'll destroy you by pouring in money to Brown. And that's another factor. There was still another factor that's quite interesting. At first was puzzling until at least I was puzzled until I found out what was going on. It turns out that among the Democratic voters, usual Democratic voters, say union members, the voting was low, but they did vote. And the majority voted for Brown, which is basically shooting themselves in the foot in the long term. But they had a reason. And the reason has become clearer from the statement anything that the majority of the population wanted, including the majority of union activists. He'd given away the public option, gave it to the insurance companies. He'd given away the Medicare buy-in, and so on down the line, just straight gifts to the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical corporations over in the opposition to the considerable majority of the population. But there was one thing that he was firm on, and told labor, I'm not going to change this. This is fixed, and that's a tax increase for union members for their health programs. And they were infuriated with that, quite rightly. That tells you something. And another factor that led to the victory. Well, now what about the Tea Party movement? Another factor in the election, which I didn't mention, is the public relations aspect. So campaigns in the United States are mostly run by the public relations industry. You know, they try to invent a character who they can sell, like the way you sell toothpaste and so on. The character Scott Brown, who was invented, was his standard appearance. He starts off by saying, I'm Scott Brown, and this is my truck. You know, and then there's a beat-up pickup truck next to him. And I'm a regular guy, and I'm an Army guy, and I'm an ordinary guy, and, you know, my daughter's a finalist in American Idol, and so I'm just kind of like a straight ordinary guy like you. Nothing like the support he was getting from the wealthy suburbs and the financial institutions. Okay, that's the fakery that's carried out by the PR industry. They do it for every candidate, and that probably had an effect too. Now, what about the Tea Party movement? Well, you know, it's an interesting and complicated movement. There are elements in it of old-fashioned American nativism, hatred of immigrants, racism, extreme militancy, and so on. You know, the kind of Sarah Palin types who say Palin gave a talk at the Tea Party convention, in which he said, "We got to declare war on Iran. We've got to give even more support for Israel, you know, militant ally." Elsewhere, she said, "We got to get rid of this nonsense about global warming. It's all fake. There's no energy crisis. God put plenty of oil underground so we can drill." You know, there's that element. On the other hand, there's another element, which is, in my view, more significant. I mean, these are people who have real grievances. There's also the element of sort of white racism. You know, the whites are becoming a persecuted minority and so on and so forth. And, you know, the rich elite Democrats who run Wall Street and run the media and the government are just giving everything away. They don't care about flyby America, you know, America between the coasts. They don't care about us ordinary guys. They just want to give everything away to illegal immigrants, you know, the shiftless poor and so on. I mean, there's an element of that. But another element, which I think is more significant, is just legitimate grievances. I mean, these are people who have really been shafted for 30 years. You take a look at U.S. policies, economic and social policies since Reagan. They have been designed so that a very small sector of the population has become extremely wealthy. We now have probably the worst inequality in American history, a very sharp difference from the early post-war years. Meanwhile, for the majority of the population, real wages have stagnated or, in the Bush years, actually declined. Benefits were never very strong, have declined. Working hours have gone way up. They're now way beyond Europe, even Japan. Social services have declined, so the schools haven't been supported, infrastructure's collapsing. Two members of the family have to work to put food on the table, but there's very little in the way of child care and child support and so on and so forth. Well, you know, these are, you know, it's not Southern Africa, South and Central Africa, but you know, for people who look around them and see the wealth and of the country, which is extraordinary, this is quite unfair, and they want to know why. They want answers. Well, you know, they're not getting answers from the liberal Democrats. They're not going to tell them, look, the reason is because we decided back in the 70s to not what they're being told. What they're being told is, you know, what they hear on Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin and the rest. You can hear it on the talk show if you like. Just what I said. There's a war against, by the liberal elitists, against us hardworking, God-fearing, you know, gun-carrying Christian Americans who do everything right, but they hate us. They're turning us into a minority and giving everything away to illegal immigrants and the shiftless poor and so on. Well, you know, that's at least an answer. It's not. It's a crazy answer, but it is an answer. I'm not getting one from anyone else. Unfortunately, this is not an unfamiliar phenomenon. It has, with all the differences, enormous differences that exist, nevertheless, it has a kind of a whiff of late Weimar Germany and the appeal of the Nazi Party to petty bourgeois and working class elements who really did have grievances. Now we're getting an answer. Crazy answer, hideous answer, but an answer. We know what happened.
Wow, that's amazing, Professor Chomsky. I'm afraid we're about out of time. From what I understand, people's attention spans have been dumbed down to about 30 minutes anyway, according to the Harvard and MIT people. But that was a very effective and profound 30 minutes. And I encourage everyone to go to ZNet and check out this really fascinating article for more information, The Corporate Takeover of U.S. Democracy. And again, that is at zcommunications.org on the Chomsky section. Thank you so much, Professor Chomsky, and I'd like to invite you back sometime for an update on all of these horrible things that are happening to our wonderful country.